This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri for Jane Lindholm. We've talked about opiate addiction on this show in ways that mirror the way all Vermonters are talking about it, the way it destroys families, how drug seeking leads to crime, whether a public health approach is more effective than criminal punishment, and how prescription drugs can lead to heroin, not to mention how much money the state is spending trying to fight the problems of addiction. But today, we're taking a different approach, the science of addiction, and what is actually happening in the neural pathways of our brains that creates an addiction. Opiates are top of mind, but alcohol, tobacco, and even behaviors are addictive too, and science can help explain a lot of it. Joining me to discuss addiction is Karen Lounsbury, professor of pharmacology at the University of Vermont Larner College of Medicine. She runs a lab that researches cellular signaling, and she's the director of the Medical Cannabis Program of Study at UVM. Karen Lounsbury, welcome to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with some brain basics. What parts of the brain are most activated when it comes to addiction?
Well, what happens in addiction is that the normal reward pathways that are found in your brain get hyperactivated. These areas of the brain are deep in the brain, and they project out to your executive functioning areas, which is the frontal cortex. And we know that the frontal cortex is very important for helping us make decisions. So if you hyperstimulate these areas of the brain, it will lead to excess reward, which then kind of hijacks your normal reward pathways.
Let's talk about that reward pathway. How does it work in a healthy, high-functioning brain?
Well, a key component is a neurotransmitter that's called dopamine. And dopamine is contained within the neurons of an area of the brain called the ventral tegmentum. And the name isn't as important as the fact that when these neurons get stimulated, they release this neurotransmitter dopamine into an area of the brain that receives the signal and then projects good feelings to the frontal cortex. And it also projects to other areas of the brain, including your anxiety centers and your areas that make you feel well-being.
Can we have too much dopamine in the brain on that pathway?
Oh, absolutely. We know that things like amphetamines will directly stimulate, and adrenaline will also directly stimulate these pathways to a level where you have hyperexcitement.
You talked about addiction as hijacking the reward pathway. So what does that mean?
Well, when you hyperstimulate this area, it leads to changes in the responses. It kind of downregulates the system so that you can only get activation of the reward pathway when you have these really strong signals, things that you get from alcohol or from heroin or from cocaine. And because those signals have changed the response of the brain, make it more tolerant, when you have a normal reward signal, say you somebody hugs you or you get an A on an exam or something that's a normal reward, you won't get that same stimulation, and you'll feel a loss, as if something's missing, unless you have the drug.
Mm. Now, scientists like you have come to understand that different drugs act on the reward pathway differently. So explain how that works.
Yeah, it's very interesting because we know that both stimulating drugs like cocaine, amphetamines, can cause addiction, but also depressants like alcohol and heroin. These are depressants that can lead to anesthesia and make you go to sleep, but they also can stimulate reward because they remove normal inhibition of the reward pathway. Normally, you have lots of neurons that are projecting into the reward pathway, so the depressants remove the inhibition, whereas the stimulants directly increase the pathway activation.
We heard from Miles, who emailed, "I'm a high school teacher, social study teacher, actually, including psychology, and the topic of addiction with teens has always been a challenge to me." He says, "What does the current research say about the development of the prefrontal cortex and addiction with regards to earlier versus later exposure to different drugs?"
Oh, that's an excellent question, because it's very clear that adolescents are much more sensitive to the possibility of becoming addicted. That doesn't mean that adults can't become addicted, but at the adolescent age, the prefrontal cortex is still developing its final piecing together of making synaptic connections and getting more fully developed. And that's partly why adolescents tend to have a little bit of poor judgment, because they haven't fully developed their judgment center. So if you hyperstimulate that area when somebody is an adolescent, they're more likely to have more permanent changes that affect a long-term, lifelong addiction.
Wow. Is there a difference between a physiological addiction and a psychological addiction?
Oh, that's a very good question, too. They're obviously very closely connected because your neurons and your feelings and your emotions are physiology. They're not completely separated. However, we know that the drugs of addiction that are more severe with respect to withdrawal effects also have effects on other physical aspects. For example, heroin is so terrible because it's constantly reducing stimulation in some parts of the brain and increasing stimulation to the reward pathway. So when you remove heroin, you have a strong physical withdrawal. Patients, they actually can feel pain, anxiety, and it's very uncomfortable. So it adds to the problem of withdrawal.
We heard from Blake as well, who emailed this question. What's the difference between an addiction and a habit? He says, I have a habit of drinking a glass of wine every day around 5 p.m., and I feel cheated if I don't get to have it for whatever reason. Am I addicted or do I have a habit?
Well, habits can become addictions if they get out of control. To define an addiction is something where somebody is compelled to have a behavioral activity. It isn't necessarily taking drugs. You can be addicted to other things and behaviors. It's a compulsion to constantly go for this certain activity. And so a habit is part of our normal physiology in general. We have a lot of habits. We have rituals that we perform throughout the day. But when having this habit becomes something that's a compulsion where you cannot get through your day without that, or if it's removed from you, you have such a loss that you will do anything to get that, then it's become an addiction.
And Karen, we're talking a lot about drugs in these addictions, but can behaviors become addictions, and do they affect the same part of the brain?
Yes, they do affect the same part of the brain. The biggest difference is that because drugs are acting directly on the pathway, they can cause changes that are actually the neurons actually change in their development. And so when you withdraw a drug, there's going to be more of a withdrawal effect. But people can become addicted to behaviors. Runners, for example, if they run every single day, they will severely miss running. And it is the same type of feeling as somebody who might be addicted to a drug. However, it's much less severe because they could replace it with something, another activity. Whereas if somebody's addicted to heroin, they cannot replace it with something else except for heroin.
I'm speaking with Karen Lounsbury about addiction and what goes on inside the brain. Let's speak with Miriam, who's calling from South Burlington. Miriam, thank you for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi. I'm wondering about the brain and once it's been overstimulated with drugs of any kind, thus addiction, whether the brain can, once you stop using the drug, whether the brain can rebound. Is there a healing process to the brain going back to normalcy?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And it seems as though if somebody has been addicted to a drug and then they go through the physical withdrawal period, which is actually a fairly short period of time. Within a week, the physical withdrawal symptoms will be removed. However, after that, there's a more long-term craving effect, so a psychological craving. And some drugs leave a much more permanent change in your brain than other drugs. Even caffeine is slightly addicting both psychologically and physically. But if you switch to decaf, you could probably not be craving that drug as much. The stronger the drug is with respect to hyperstimulating and changing the reward pathway, the harder it is for a patient to continue to not use the drug, which is why with heroin addicts, they oftentimes have to replace with a lower level stimulation of a what we call a partial agonist drug that will stimulate the reward pathway slightly, and they may have to maintain on that for the rest of their lives because they can't ever completely go back to normalcy. But in most cases, they can recover and will be able to, if they continue treatment, to kind of recover the changes that happened in their brain.
So does the brain physically change as we become addicted to a drug?
Yes, it does, with respect to there are receptors for the drugs. And these receptors, if they get hyperstimulated, they do what we call downregulate. So they're less sensitive. This happens with many people who have either been drinking coffee or smoking cigarettes or drinking alcohol, the legal drugs. You become tolerant to it. So it takes more cigarettes, more alcohol. And that's the reason why, is because your brain has become tolerant to those drugs, and tolerance is at the physical neuron level. So these changes are physical changes in your neurons, and they can somewhat go back to normal, but some of the connections will be permanently changed.
Okay, so how do you know this? How do you observe these changes? What technology are you using to study those changes in the brain?
Well, it mostly is done in models of either cells, where you isolate neurons, or from animal models, where you can look within the brains of animals while they're alive and functioning. You can measure changes. What we know in people is mostly from doing tests of putting in electrodes that can measure different brain activity or measure the amount of oxygen that your different areas of the brain are using. They do know with animal models that if you inject a small amount of dopamine, that neurotransmitter I talked about,
yep,
right into the reward pathway, that animal will do almost anything to get that stimulation if they have to press a lever or something to get it.
Okay, and if the addiction happens in a teenage brain versus an adult brain, is the potential for reversal or repair any different?
I don't know that there's much known about whether it's easier to reverse, but I do know that it's definitely more vulnerable population of the young people in having an addiction and a more severe addiction. But I don't know if it's easier to reverse. That's a very good question. It's possible that it is, because they do have more plastic brain, you know, they haven't developed completely, so maybe they could heal faster as well.
All right, let's take a look at differences between things like tobacco, alcohol, heroin, and marijuana, and how the brain reacts and thus becomes addicted.
Yeah, so nicotine has a very interesting effect on the reward pathway, because the first couple of times somebody uses nicotine, it actually stimulates a high, or like a stimulation of the brain. It feels almost like an adrenaline rush. But then after somebody is addicted to nicotine, it switches and becomes more of an anti-anxiety drug. It's very interesting. It actually changes which receptors it's affecting. And so you go from when you're first getting addicted to feeling energized by smoking to later feeling loss of your anxiety, like you just feel anxious if you don't have a cigarette. So that's with nicotine. With alcohol, it's much more confusing, because alcohol is like a general anesthetic. It affects almost all parts of the brain. And so how it affects the reward pathway is really still argued amongst people, because it can have so many effects on the brain. Yeah. But in general, we know it removes inhibition of the reward pathway.
Let's take another call. Samantha is joining us from Jeffersonville. Samantha, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. This is such a fascinating subject. I heard you speak of amphetamines being addictive, and I'm wondering about the differences in the baseline of the brain of the different people pursuing these drugs for their effect. I know that with ADHD, the treatment is, for example, Adderall and Ritalin, excuse me. So I'm wondering about the baseline of the brains of the people becoming addicted. Are people becoming addicted because of a pre-existing neurological disorder? Is this being researched at all? Is there testing? Are there methods? So I'd really love to hear your thoughts on this.
Thanks, Samantha.
Yeah, that's a highly researched topic. We know that patients who have ADHD have a slightly decreased normal reward pathway stimulation. And that leads to them seeking out higher reward signaling. And in some cases, you may hear of, you know, the greatest skateboarder or the greatest snowmobile racer has ADHD or ADD. And it's partly because those patients tend to seek out really high stimulating reward pathways. And so when you take a drug like Adderall, for example, it is a mild amphetamine. And so what that's doing is it's slightly increasing the stimulation, the reward pathway. And those amphetamines are different from the drugs of addiction in that they're much more mild, and they also don't cause as much of what I was talking about, that tolerance where you have changes and you need more and more drug. If you use Adderall at the dose you're supposed to use it at, it really shouldn't cause those types of changes. It just gives a little tweak and prevents those patients from lacking that normal baseline reward that you were talking about. And we do know also that patients that have ADD are at slightly higher risk of becoming addicted to stimulant drugs, partly because of that they're seeking normal reward at a higher level.
We had this email from Marianne who writes, "My child's pediatrician says that kids can become addicted to their electronic devices. Can this happen? And can addiction to an iPad, an iPod, an iPhone of addictions lead to drug or alcohol addictions?"
Well, they definitely can be somewhat addicted to the behaviors in that the reward, you get the same types of little dopamine squirts in your brain when you have reward on any type of electronic signal, whether it's, you know, winning at a video game or whether it's somebody liking a picture on Facebook. Those are little small rewards. And if a child is continuing to use that daily, it can become like an addiction. But similar to what I was talking about before with heroin, the difference is that when it's removed, it doesn't have that same strong physical withdrawal that leads to a patient to feel really sick when they're removed from the drug. And that sickness really helps to promote the compulsion to use the drug. And in the case of video games or something, if a child's removed, they will feel a psychological withdrawal. There's no question. And it is like a behavioral addiction. But if they move to other activities, they should be able to more quickly get reward from other types of stimulation, unlike a drug addiction where you have the physical withdrawal.
I'm speaking with Karen Lounsbury, professor of pharmacology at the University of Vermont Larner College of Medicine, and we're talking about the real root causes of addiction. Just ahead, we'll talk about how marijuana is understood through the lens of addiction. We've tried to look at the opioid addiction crisis on this show from every angle. Today, we're looking at what causes addiction inside the brain, and not just to opioids, but to alcohol, tobacco, even behaviors. Karen Lounsbury is a professor of pharmacology at the University of Vermont Larner College of Medicine. She's explaining what happens in the brain that causes these addictions. Now, Karen, we've touched on a little bit of the differences between these different drugs, but let's go into it a little more with tobacco first. This is highly addictive. There's 32% of those who use it become dependent on it. I believe that's the highest of any of the drugs that we kind of really look at. So what specifically happens in their brain to cause that addiction?
Well, there's still a lot to know about nicotine. What I was talking about a little earlier, where the short-term use leads to stimulation, whereas long-term use leads to like this more permanent change in the brain that causes anxiety if a patient doesn't use the nicotine. And it's that second phase that makes tobacco, nicotine in the tobacco is what is the addicting part, that causes the nicotine to require activity in the brain for the person not to feel anxious. And nicotine stimulates a receptor that actually opens an ion channel and allows sodium ions into those neurons that stimulate the release of dopamine. And it's a very specific ion channel. It's the same type of ion channel that some of our muscles use, which is why when you have nicotine, you also feel some changes. There's a slight increase in blood pressure, slight increase in activity of your muscles. But it's really that stimulation of the changes that have happened in the brain in your reward pathway that keep causing compulsion to use the nicotine, you know, making it really both psychologically and physically addicting.
Now, heroin is another highly addictive drug. Does it affect the brain differently than tobacco and nicotine?
It's different because it's removing inhibition of the reward pathway rather than stimulating it directly. And there are several different types of circuits that lead into the brain that slightly inhibit reward. And a good example with heroin is to go back to opioids and morphine, which we use it for pain relief. When a person is in pain, their reward pathway is suppressed. So you really generally don't feel happy when you're in pain. Part of that reason is because that whole area of the brain is being suppressed. So when you use an opioid, part of the reason why it's such a good painkiller is it also removes some of the inhibition of the reward pathway and makes patients feel better. Doesn't just remove the pain in the arm that they might be treating, but it also makes them feel better. So when you take heroin, you're removing that inhibition very strongly. And especially if you inject the drug, it's happening very quickly. And so patients feel high and this rarely strong feeling of happiness, basically. And so if they continually use heroin, their brain will be changed and it won't respond as well to normal rewards that would remove that inhibition. So it's slightly different because it's a little stronger physically addicting than nicotine is, but they're both high psychologically addicting.
Does cocaine work in a different way from heroin?
Yeah, cocaine stops the turn off of the reward. So nicotine stimulates reward. Opioids remove suppression of the reward. And cocaine stops the reward from being turned off. So it acts like a stimulant. It keeps the dopamine hanging around in the brain. And so cocaine is also very powerful psychologically. It's not quite as powerful of a physically addicting drug. But it's very powerful psychologically. So it's a difficult addiction.
Is there a physiological reason why alcohol and marijuana are less addicting than drugs like tobacco and heroin?
Well, I would kind of dispute that alcohol is less addicting because alcohol is still a big problem with addiction. Part of that is because so many patients use alcohol. So while those that use it, there are a lot of people who can use alcohol recreationally without becoming addicted. So that's true, that maybe the percentage is a little bit lower of people mm-hmm. who become dependent. But once a patient is dependent on alcohol, the physical addiction is very strong. It's like you're taking a general anesthetic every day. So when you remove it, the anxiety and the hyperstimulation of the brain is not comfortable. With marijuana, it has a similar effect as the opioids in the reward pathway. The big difference is that it doesn't have nearly as many of the receptors for cannabinoids in that area of the brain. So it doesn't have nearly as powerful of a reward pathway stimulation. But it does still have, a small percentage of patients do become dependent.
Now, we did hear from Judy in South Burlington who asked, could you comment on marijuana and its place in addiction with regard to motivation and paranoia?
Yeah, the cannabinoid receptors are found pretty highly in the area of the brain that's important for anxiety, the amygdala it's called. And so some patients will respond to smoking cannabis with an anxiety effect. It will make them feel paranoid, or if they take too much. We have a lot of problem with anxiety in patients that use edibles because they don't realize how much they've taken until they all of a sudden feel like they're going to die or they feel awful because of that anxiety center. But in some patients, a smaller dose of marijuana will cause a relaxation and loss of anxiety. And that's because different areas of the brain are kind of connected. With motivation, that's a problem with cannabis in that, especially adolescents, it does have a tendency to demotivate. Mm-hmm. And that's probably because it's causing a reduction in the frontal cortex stimulation. There's a lot of receptors for cannabinoids in the frontal cortex. And so it is a bit of a problem with adolescents. So definitely not recommended, at least not the full marijuana for use in teenagers and adolescents.
Let's take another call from Louise this time. She's calling from Brabant, Quebec. Louise, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hello, and thank you. I just wanted to mention that there are neurotransmitter tests available for people. It's an easy one. It's done as in urine analysis. Also, I'd like to add that people should be taking supplements of amino acids And this is what is going to power up your brain and balance everything. And those who are suffering pain, the D-L-phenylalanine will block pain messages from the brain. So there are all sorts of things you can do. Now, the neurotransmitter tests are available at the, I believe there are two labs in the U.S., the only ones available. Also, the PATH Center in New York, under the direction of Dr. Eric Braverman. His book, The Edge Effect, is also available if you want to read about it. And it's a nonprofit organization at the PATH Center, P-A-T-H.
All right, Louise, well, let me put this to Karen Lounsbury. I guess, first of all, what do you know about these tests and then the use of amino acids?
Well, we know that all the neurotransmitters are made from amino acids. So you do need amino acids in order to make neurotransmitters. I know that there are a lot of nutritional-type supplements that have amino acids, and we do have some problems in some patients that are lacking certain amino acids if their diet doesn't contain enough protein, and especially athletes that may need to supplement their amino acids. And there's a lot of new research that's being done in nutrition as far as what types of nutrition can lead to higher functioning brain. The problem is that we can't tell for sure in the case of depression or addiction whether those amino acids are actually changing the amino acid content in those areas of the brain. And measuring it in the urine does give you a sense of whether a patient might be lacking a certain amino acid. So in that case, it could be useful for seeing if a patient had a nutrient supplement deficiency. But it doesn't tell you whether a patient is addicted to drugs or going to be depressed or going to have some other mental problem. So I think that those amino acid nutrients are interesting and that we do need good nutrition. And I certainly wouldn't be opposed to research that's trying to see if we can have improved nutrition that leads to better outcome.
Let's take another call from Jack, this time calling from Orange. Hi, Jack. How you doing?
Hello. I forgot your name, so I'll just, you can hear me okay, right?
We can. Go right ahead.
Okay, good. I want to ask you about alcoholism, because I've been told by doctors that alcoholism is truly a disease versus marijuana, cocaine, or heroin use, and that if you quit drinking, just say, for 10 or 15 years, and then you started drinking again, it would reverse that and quickly bring you back. That 10 years would be reversed, and you would be just like it was if you'd been drinking the whole time. Whereas if you had done opiates or marijuana and quit for 10 years and started again, it wouldn't do that. And if you have the gene in you of alcoholism, which is kind of ancestral, that it has a different effect on you than other drugs. And I just wanted to ask you about the true meaning of the word disease and drug addiction and alcoholism.
All right. Let's put that to Karen Lounsbury.
Yeah, I think that the term disease has been used for drug addiction because to get away from the stigma that patients that are addicted to drugs have a pure choice in what they do. And the problem with addiction is that they get to a physiological point where they simply do not really have a choice but to compulsively seek a drug. Alcoholism has a lot of changes that happen in the body with chronic alcohol use. And one of them is the reward pathway stimulation. But there are a lot of other things that happen because it's metabolized in your liver and you have a lot of long-term liver complications. And what you said, though, about the difference between alcohol and heroin isn't completely true, because heroin addicts have that same problem where they can stop using heroin for 10 years and then they can still have the tendency that if they do use again, that they will go back to being addicted to the drug again. And these are because you have some permanent changes that occur with long-term addiction. And alcohol in particular is a problem because it's all around us. There are so many people that are using it recreationally that it's very difficult for somebody who had an alcohol addiction to never use again. Whereas somebody who's addicted to heroin might not have as much trouble by just staying out of those kind of environments. So with alcohol, it's a particularly difficult problem. And it is true that you can become re-addicted. You never lose that physiological change in your brain.
Wendy is calling from Manchester with a question. Hi, Wendy. Go right ahead.
Hi. If someone has a predisposition to addiction, for example, if they have addiction in their family, how are their brains different, making them more susceptible to getting addicted more easily?
I'm glad you asked that question because I didn't get to that. And the last caller had also asked about predisposition. They are starting to learn that there are some genes that are involved in somebody, not necessarily meaning you're going to become addicted, but that you may have a predisposition. And it's those same pathways I was talking about in the brain that secrete dopamine. And if you have an inappropriate reuptake of dopamine, or, you know, funneling the dopamine out of the system, or hyperstimulation because you have a mutation, we call it a mutation, but oftentimes they're called normal changes that people have between themselves. But if you have that change that makes it a little less likely for the dopamine to be taken out of the system, or more likely, you can have a predisposition to having an addiction. And it does tend to run in families, but not always. It's a lot like some of the cancer genes where it predisposes you, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get a cancer, but you have a slightly high likelihood of risk.
Karen, we've spent a lot of time talking about addiction. Let's talk about ending addiction. How easy is it for someone to just stop using whatever their drug of choice is?
It's very difficult. And I would say if somebody has a family member or a friend who has an addiction problem, that they need a lot of support, because it's the same type of thing as if you think of eating as kind of an addiction. If you were forced not to eat for days, it's really physiologically you have a compulsion to eat. And it's somewhat similar to that and you keep thinking, oh, well, this is a choice. They just need to stop drinking or stop using heroin. But it's not that easy. So both counseling and having maybe some physical change, like for nicotine, using nicotine patches, or for heroin, using the drug Suboxone, which is a partial heroin-type drug, but less potent. And I'm also having a lot of continued, not just for 1 year, but for decades of support.
Well, what happens in the brain when someone withdraws or discontinues these drugs?
Well, one example is with alcohol, because you've had brain suppression, like you're taking a general anesthetic. Now you have a hyperexcitable brain, and there have been cases of alcoholics who go cold turkey, so to speak, and they actually can have seizures because their brain is so hyperstimulated. And with heroin, there are some semi-permanent changes that happen in that reward pathway that cause it to always desire the stimulation.
When we overcome an addiction, for one thing, are we any more likely to be addicted to something else, even a behavior?
Yes. Once somebody is addicted to a drug, they are oftentimes co-addicted. So an alcoholic is much more likely to be a nicotine addict as well, because the nicotine gives a positive stimulant and the alcohol is a depressant. So you're much more likely to be codependent. But also, once somebody has stopped using heroin, they are at slightly higher risk of using other drugs of abuse as well.
And Karen, what research horizon most excites you right now? What is it? What's the next addiction mystery that you want to solve?
I think that if we can find ways to temper addiction by using either medication or behavioral tactics to try and reduce, once somebody has decided, I want to stop using whatever drug it is they're addicted to have something that will really help them on a long-term basis so that they don't go back to the drug again.
Karen Lounsbury is a professor of pharmacology at the University of Vermont Larner College of Medicine, where she runs a lab that researches cellular signaling. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.